The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I'd like to add my welcome. My name is Andrea, for those of you who I've not met before. And a couple of weeks ago when I was here, I talked about the topic of delusion and how our minds kind of misinterpret and misunderstand things. And that's a good aspect, a facet of how our minds delude us. And in that discussion, I talked about kind of there's aspects of delusion which include kind of being spaced out and confused about experience, a kind of a dullness or a spaciness around what's going on. And then there's an aspect of delusion that relates to our views and ideas about what's going on, at a personal or psychological level. So, for instance, we might have views and opinions about who we are and what we're capable of, or views and opinions about what our friends are and what they're capable of, or views and opinions about society and what it's supposed to be like. And those views may or may not be true. And so this is another aspect for us to look into with respect to our minds. Are we confusing ourselves? Are we deluding ourselves by holding views that are not true? And then the third aspect, or the third level of delusion, the more kind of core or fundamental level that we all share as human beings, is kind of core misperceptions about how reality is structured, I could say, I guess. And there are three core misperceptions that we tend to take what is impermanent to be permanent. That when we navigate our lives, we mistakenly attribute permanence to certain experiences, certain things. And it may not be that we're attributing undying permanence to things, but we tend to, like, for instance, even just something as simple as, maybe not so simple, as a relationship. That we, have a sense of, yes, this relationship, this is going to last for the rest of my life, and this is going to make me happy for the rest of my life. And we find that not necessarily so. So the way our minds tend to navigate the world, kind of just partly because of a function of the way our minds meet experience, like just, the simple aspect of walking into a building like this and seeing the walls and the chairs and the windows and the other people, there's ways that we take this as being permanent. That maybe not forever permanent, because we know enough from, cultures of thousands of years ago that we see the decay of the civilizations. But we think this is going to be here tomorrow. It's got that kind of permanence to us. And yet it may not be. The hurricane on the East Coast simply showed that for many people who lived in certain areas near the coast. And here in California, with earthquakes, we never know when our structures are going to crumble. And so, our minds attribute a permanence to things, partly because it's a shortcut, a way of navigating our world. And it's also, I think, a part about our deep need for some kind of stability and security in our lives. It's a scary thing to go around recognizing that, I might go home and not have a home tonight. So there's it's a truth. And I think we all kind of sort of acknowledge that as a truth, but we don't live that as a truth. And so this is a kind of delusion that we live with. So that's one of our fundamental delusions. Another fundamental delusion that we live with is that we take what is unreliable as a reliable source of happiness. That we attribute things in the two things in the world, to relationships, to other people, to objects in the world, that they've got some power to make us happy. And this is a deep mistake, because the things in the world, the relationships, the objects of the world, again, because they're impermanent, they're not a terribly reliable place. We can't really hang our hat on these things and say, yes, this thing is going to be around and it's going to make me happy forever. And so we tend to misattribute where we can find our happiness. We think we'll find our happiness by accumulating things, by finding the perfect relationship, by having the good house, by arranging our world. We think we'll find happiness through arranging our world so that it suits our designs. And again, this is a kind of a misperception, a misunderstanding of where happiness actually, or a deeper kind of happiness actually can lie. There is a happiness of having things and having a relationship. There is a happiness in that. And this is, in the Buddha's teachings, he clearly acknowledges this. Yes, there's happiness in this kind of sense pleasure, in the realm of the senses where we have interactions with people and get to eat good food and have nice things around us and have good friends and relationships. And that does bring a kind of happiness. But it is not the kind of happiness that's very reliable, because it is happiness that is dependent on things that are inherently falling apart, that are inherently impermanent. And so the Buddha suggested we actually might find a deeper, kind of more reliable kind of happiness by looking into our own hearts and seeing if we could let go, perhaps, of the need to arrange the world to suit us. So those are two of these three kinds of, there's three main kinds of misperceptions. The third kind of misperception, which I got to about 2 minutes before the end of the talk, is this notion of the understanding, or the confusion around taking what is not self to be self. And, 2 minutes isn't a very big time to go into what that even means, so I thought I would explore that topic tonight. What does it mean? What does it mean that we take what is not self to be self? What is this teaching around not self? How do we understand it? How do we explore it? So what does it mean? The Buddha talked about it as being this taking what is not self to be self as one of these fundamental misunderstandings, essentially, that we attribute selfhood to something that does not have the qualities of self, or does not have any of what we even think of as self. When we start looking into it, what do we think of as self? And then we start investigating our experience, we begin to see that there's some mismatch there. So I'd like to explore that with you tonight. So first thing I'd like to just explore, check in with you, is what is it that you think of as self? Just name some things and just call them out. We don't need to use the mic for this. I'll just repeat whatever. Just, what is it that you think of when you think of me or I am? What is it? Past experiences, so the notion of memory, or that's the kind of the accumulation of my experience is who I am. what I think. I am what I think. That's a good Western philosophical view. I think, therefore, I am, from Descartes.
Such aspects of my personality as are embedded or derived from my DNA.
So such aspects of your personality that seem to derive from your DNA. So what's inborn? And there was something over here. The story that we tell ourselves. This is who I am. This is what I do. This is that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
My physical experiences.
Physical experiences. Okay. Physical experiences.
My physical body.
Your physical body. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Your name?
There can be an interesting sense of that, of identification with, you know, that we become that, or that somehow the name kind of collapses who we are into it. It's an idea then. It's kind of an idea that congeals around the name. Anything else?
Accomplishments,
okay. So what I have done, so a resume. So here, my curriculum vitae, here it is. This is me. And I heard something else over here.
My feelings.
Your feelings, okay. Anything else? One or two more, if you can think of any more.
What
you like and what you don't like. That's we kind of congeal around that. You know, that's me. Maybe one more.
An inner voice.
So kind of, that sounds kind of like the narrator in a way. Yeah. So, I was preparing a talk on an aspect of this for a retreat that I taught last week. And I decided to explore for myself in a very simple way while I was in the gym. The various ways I felt like I was me. And I don't have them written down here, so I'll just have to try to remember them. But the first one that came in, that appeared, was something along the lines of, well, I'm the one doing this exercise. I was in the gym, so I was doing stair climbing. So I'm the one doing. So that there's the notion of control, or the notion of intention or agency, that was kind of first up. That was the first thing that came up, is I'm the one that's doing this. And then there was the sense that that there was a sense of my body, that I was in my body. So there was a feeling of being identified with the body, but it felt like I was in the body. And then there was a sense of the unpleasant feelings that were going on. And they were definitely mine. Those feelings were mine. And they were in me. No, those feelings were in my body. But they were in me. So in that way, I saw that I also felt like my body was me. Because the feelings were in me. But the feelings were in my body. I can't remember. I think there were one or two more, but you know, just kind of exploring some of the key pieces. So all the things that you've mentioned, the Buddha actually kind of explored this notion of self, and he touched on, I think, the ways that he described it. He kind of divided up our experience into five different categories, and pretty much, I think, everything you mentioned comes under one of those categories. So I won't go into that so much right now, but what I will describe is a little bit about how he talked about the ways we get confused about this self. and how he approached helping us to say, well, okay, maybe this self idea is one that's not quite so well defined. I mean, just my little exploration while I was in the gym, I saw just how much shifting and changing there was around what I took to be myself. It wasn't one thing. It was so many different shifting and changing things. It was, I was in my body. I was my body. I wasn't my body at all. I was the one who controlled the body. So there was a whole bunch of different ways that I felt like I was a self. So in the this happens to be the discourse that I'm going to talk about, happens to be the second discourse that the Buddha gave. The second time he gave a teaching after he became enlightened, he talked about this teaching of not self. And he explored it in terms of these three confusions that we have. You know, that the three aspects of experience that experience is inherently impermanent, unreliable, and how those relate to this notion of not self. So the first thing he said is that with whatever's going on in our experience, and these five things he broke down, and you'll recognize some of these things. I'll just mention these, but I won't go into describing what they each are in much depth right now. He said that we tend to identify around our body. So that was brought up. We tend to identify around our feelings. We tend to identify around our ideas, our thoughts, our perceptions. We tend to identify around our intentions. And we tend to identify around consciousness or knowing. So those are the five areas that he highlighted. And then when he was talking in the second discourse, the first piece he brought up are any of these aspects of our experience under our control? Often when we think about what we mean by a sense of self, there's some notion of control or agency. You know, that if something belongs to me, if something is mine, or if I am something, there's a sense that I have control over that thing. I mean, just like this movement of my hand, I have some control over that. You know, it's like that that movement of my body in the gym, going in the stair climbing, you know, that it felt like I had control over my body. So there's a limited amount of control there that's there. The Buddha pointed out that, you know, the notion of self we think of as somehow, you know, having ultimate control. And we clearly do not have ultimate control over our experience or our body. So here's how he worded it. He said, form or body is not self. If form were self, the body would not lend itself to affliction, and it would be possible to determine of the body, let my body be thus, let my body not be thus. But because form is not self, body leads to affliction, and it is not possible to say, let my body be thus, let my body not be thus. And he goes through that same reflection with each of these five areas. So I'll just read the last one, because this one is kind of it's poignant, but we can really see this. Consciousness is not self. If consciousness were self, consciousness would not lend itself to affliction, and it would be possible to determine of consciousness, let my consciousness be thus, let my consciousness not be thus. But because consciousness is not self, consciousness leads to affliction. It is not possible to say, let my consciousness be thus, let my consciousness not be thus. So, you know, this comes up all the time. You know, how great would it be if we could say, let my consciousness be thus. You know, let me be happy all the time. Let me never have sorrow, sadness. And the Buddha is point. What the Buddha is pointing out here is that when we can't do that, it's not our fault. It's not a mistake. It's not something we've done wrong when we can't say, let my consciousness be thus. I mean, even just the simple act of meditation points this out to us over and over again. We sit down and basically say, may I be mindful? May my mind stay present with my breath. You know, how long does that last? Two breaths, maybe three, 10 if you're lucky. You know, it doesn't last for long. The mind has its own thing, you know. It goes off wandering away. Now, did you do that? Was that you that wandered off? Or was it you that were trying to stay present? And then, even more amazing, is that moment when you finally wake up. You know, who did that? You come back from a wandering thought. You know, who did that? That just happened. This is actually one of the ways this delusion of self is kind of pernicious in a way, because there's evidence all over the place for the truth of not self. But our belief and view in self is such that it kind of obscures for us this evidence. The simple fact that we sit down and meditate and we don't have control over our minds, that it wanders off and that it wakes up, is evidence for this truth of not self. So that's the first aspect he talked about, was that there's not control over our experience, over our minds, over our bodies. We don't have control. Now, there's some aspect, there's some level of agency. There is a kind of an agency, and it's not a self that's in charge of that agency. And that's a little hard for us to grok, actually. It's a little hard for us to understand. Because it feels like, you know, I'm sitting at the computer and I experience thirst, and, you know, it feels like, well, I'm the one that decides to get up and go get a glass of water. You know, there's that feeling of agency that's created when that happens. But when we start actually looking into what happens there, we start actually exploring the unfolding of the events. And you're sitting at the computer, sit there for a couple hours maybe. The body gets thirsty. And that's a kind of a condition that happens when you don't take a drink for a while. So there's thirst that arises in the body. That thirst conditions the desire to alleviate that thirst. That desire to alleviate that thirst then conditions an intention to act to get some water. There doesn't actually have to be an I or a me in there making that choice. It actually comes about after the fact, in a way. This notion that I decided that comes about after the fact. There's a kind of this unfolding process of cause and effect. Experiences in the body condition the arising of experiences in the mind. You know, the dryness in the mouth conditions the desire to alleviate the dryness. That then conditions in the mind put into motion more conditions in the mind. An intention is born. Do something about that. This intention is born to take some action. The body and mind take care of itself. And there's not really anyone there to do that. Now, you don't have to believe this. and you may have some, you know, skepticism or sense of this not being true. I mean, it is such a deeply felt feeling, this feeling that I am. It is so deep that it's, I'm not trying to convince you that that notion is a mistake, but I am hoping to kind of open your mind to explore the possibility that there may be something else going on that we don't deeply understand. So just see if you can take this in and just explore with me this question. So another aspect of this teaching around not self is that the Buddha pointed to all of our experience being impermanent and unreliable. And that there's a way, kind of, that we attribute a sense of permanence to a self. Whatever it is we think of as self, we think it's abiding. We think it's a thing. Whether we think it's a thing that's here and is going to be reborn in the future, you know, that there's kind of a soul. That's one of the ways that the self is sometimes considered as a soul. Whether we think of it in that way, or we think of it as something that's here now, that's going to never be here at the end of our life, you know, kind of the sense of something's here, but it's not going to be here. There's a way that we attribute a thingness to our sense of self, a sense of permanence, a sense of actuality to it, an existence. We attribute an existence to it. So the Buddha said that if we look at any aspect of our experience, just start looking at aspects of our experience, is there anything in our experience that is permanent? And we start actually looking at what do I take to be self, like in my example around the going to the gym. You know, the feeling of me being the one who's doing it kind of gave way to me being the one who was experiencing the unpleasant sensations. So that there wasn't a sense, when I started actually looking at it, there wasn't a sense of there being a real solidity or sameness to what I thought of as self. And when we really start exploring this, actually, it's quite remarkable, especially with our meditative capacity, with our ability to look into our experience. We start to see that what I'm taking to be self changes moment to moment. It can change moment to moment very radically. And this, again, is more evidence for the truth of this understanding of not self. There was a retreat I was on, and it was a long retreat. It was a 3-month retreat. I was spending some time on that retreat having a lot of thoughts around a person who was asking questions in the morning session. There was a guy that kept asking these questions in the morning session, and this guy kind of made me nuts. So what I found myself doing at times while I was doing walking meditation was arguing with this guy in my mind. You know, self-righteous, you know, I'm right, I've got the right answer. A very strong feeling of self around this. And I felt this. I noticed this sense of, yeah, this is me. You know, I'm right. And I had a very strong sense at that time. I think I was about 40 or something, 40 years old, and I had a really strong sense of myself as being the 40-year-old, analytical, intelligent, right person. I knew that I was right, and so I was congealed around this. It was a very familiar feeling. It's a very familiar sense of this is who I am, this intellectual, analytical person. And very, I could see it was an identity, and I could also see how much suffering it was causing me in the moment. But anyway, so I was sitting there trying to be with this, you know, noticing all of the pain and suffering around this, noticing the thoughts, recognizing the feeling of self. I was hanging out with that. And some of you, I think, have heard this story. I was doing walking meditation outside the front of the building, and this truck drove up. It was a loud truck. It was a big delivery truck, and it came up, and it stopped, and the brakes squealed, and then there was the loud blast of air with the brakes releasing, and then the clang of the back of the gate of the truck. And my mind, like in a second, flipped to, oh, it's a truck. And in a moment, my mind became like a two-year-old, just reveling in the noise and the joy of standing next to this truck. The 40-year-old had vanished, completely vanished. And it was very startling to see, because I can now see that I was like kind of identified with the, you know, the kind of childlike joy of being next to this truck. And it had happened in a split second. That shift had happened in a split second. And I could also see there was no connection between these two selves. You know, there was nothing in common there. So this kind of experience happens to us, but we don't necessarily see how distinct these experiences are and how unrelated they are. You know, if we think about it, we all have many kinds of identities. You know, we have identities of being a child or perhaps a parent, or we have identities of being a partner, or we have an identity of being a meditator, or a friend, or a worker. We have all these identities. And when you're a worker, where is the child? And when you're the child, where is the friend? You know, they're not necessarily related identities. So just starting to explore this, you know, this kind of begins to undermine this notion of permanence of what we think of as self, and beginning to explore what is it that we think of as self? What does it feel like when we're, yeah, this is me? You know, just beginning to check in. Okay, this is what me feels like right now. And then checking in a day later. Is it the same? Is it the same feeling? Is it a different feeling? For myself, I found there's quite a few kind of very familiar feelings of self. Like my mind and body will go into certain kind of like you drop into, oh, yep, that's me. You know, that's just like a very familiar pattern of the way the body feels, the way the mind is working, the kinds of thoughts it thinks, the feelings that there are. This is just kind of packages that we get familiar with. It's like, yep, that's me. I mean, I had miserable knees, you know. I was really identified with being miserable, and yep, that's me. I'm miserable. And, you know, if I was happy, it was like, well, yeah, I'm happy now, but I know that's not really me. We can, you know, put ourselves in these identities. You know, kind of that they're like gravitational fields because we're familiar with them. And we drop back into them. But they are simply constructions. They are products of conditioning, products of our memories, our history, who we've been, what we've done, what we've accomplished. All of those things kind of come together to create kind of familiar, comfortable senses of ourselves with our experience. So there's this notion of permanence with respect to self, but when we begin actually exploring what it is we take to be self, we see there isn't really a permanence there. There's also in this sutta this notion, at the time of the Buddha, this one may or may not be relevant for us in a way in terms of what we think of as self or what we think of as an ultimate sense of self. In the time of the Buddha, there was kind of a sense that what the ideal self or the ultimate self or what we, you know, kind of the big self, we sometimes might think of, you know, our personality being a little self, but that there was a notion of, you know, kind of merging into a larger self, and that larger self, merging into that larger self, would be a permanent blissful abiding. And so there was a notion in a way that the sense of the larger self had a blissful quality to it. You know, this is kind of the notion of, you know, going to heaven or something almost. You know, that notion of, you know, someday, if I'm really good, then everything will be always wonderful. And so the Buddha, looking into our experience again, pointed out that there's nothing in our experience that is always blissful. You know, there's everything is coming and going. All of these feelings that we have, they come and go. And so there's nothing that qualifies in our experience, nothing in our experience that can possibly qualify as this permanent abiding being that can be always blissful. And so he was coming from a purely experiential perspective. Look into your experience and see, is there anything actually here that we can point to and say, that's me? When we start doing that, when we start looking at, well, that's what feels like me, when we start actually exploring it, we see it doesn't last for very long. And it's certainly not very satisfactory. In fact, it seems like very often, as in my example of the 40-year-old argumentative Andrea, you know, that caused a lot of suffering in that moment. And this is actually an understanding that the Buddha offers us, is that this process, and this is what he explains to us, actually, that what we take to be self is not... It's not that there's nothing there. And this is sometimes a misunderstanding that people have. It's like, well, you know, well, it sure feels like there's something here. The Buddha said, well, it's not that there's nothing there, but it's a process. It's not a thing. It's a flow of changing experience. It's nothing that can be looked at as being, here it is, forevermore unchanging. Reliable, stable. Nothing in our experience is stable. And when we start looking at what we call self, we see that. We start seeing that. So looking at self as a process, a couple of analogies for you. You know, if you think about a river, what do we call a river? What is the river? You know, is the river the water that's flowing? And if you take a bucket of that water out of the river, you know, you can't really say, well, that bucket of water is the river. And you know that the water actually is kind of coming out of the sky, running down the mountain, flowing through the stream, ending up in the ocean, evaporating back into the atmosphere and coming back down somewhere else on the planet. So the water itself is a flow. It's not something that we can point to and say, yep, that water there. You know, by the time you've pointed to it, it's already moved on. So maybe the riverbed is the river. Well, if there's a riverbed and no water, well, is that really a river? And we know that, you know, with floods and storms that the rivers can change course. So while the riverbed is maybe a little more stable than the water, it also is a process. It's been created out of the flow of the water and, you know, the amount of water that's flowing, the trees and rocks and things that are in the path and the moving around, the flow of the water moving around and cutting the channel. Again, it's a process by which this riverbed is created. So maybe it's the name of the river. Well, that doesn't make much sense. I mean, we think about a map, you know, it's like, well, it represents the river, but it's not really the river. So this is a kind of a way that we can see in our own experience. What we call me is a flow. It's a change. It's a set of conditions, a changing set of conditions. Nothing is very stable for very long. Even our DNA, even our bodies, they're kind of some of the more stable aspects of our experience. You know, the body is around for, a little bit longer than a thought. But even in the body, you know, I read somewhere that the entire body, except for perhaps some of the neurons, is replaced every 7 years. You know, it's like there's a flow even to the cells in our body. This reminds me of a stand-up comedian I saw who held up this hatchet, and he said, "This is George Washington's hatchet. It's the very one he used to chop down that cherry tree." He said, "Of course, the handle wore out, and we had to replace the handle. And, yeah, the head had to be replaced, too. But it occupies the same space." You know, that's kind of our mind. We occupy the same space, so it feels like it's here. Another analogy around the process nature and how we attribute, kind of mistakenly perhaps, attribute a thingness to something. So think about a rainbow. Now, what's a rainbow? It's got a kind of existence. You know, we can see it and we can talk about it, we can share it. It's not that it's so, you know, it's kind of an ephemeral thing, but if you're standing, you know, in the same place with somebody, you can both say, "Oh, look at the rainbow." So it's kind of got an existence to it. But what is that existence? What is the existence of the rainbow? It depends on conditions. It depends on there being water in the sky between the sun and the observer. Is that right? It's on the other side? I think it's between the sun and the observer. Anyway, there's a relationship there between the position of the sun, the position of the observer, and the position of the water in the sky. If any one of those three is not there, the rainbow is not there. The rainbow depends on these conditions coming together. It's kind of like that with ourself, with our sense of self. Our sense of self is a process rather than a thing. So there is a kind of a continuity to that process, much as there's a kind of a continuity to a river. You know, that you can come back to a river day after day, and roughly there's similarities, but if you come back to that river every day and you actually look, you know, the water some days may be muddy and churned up, and some days it's higher, some days it's lower, depending on how much rain there's been. You know it's not the same water. It's rushing past. But there is a kind of a process there that's the river. And likewise, there's a process here that is what we call a human being. And so it's a misunderstanding of that process, that we take that process and we attribute a solidity to it. And that mistake of attributing solidity to that process gets us into deep trouble. Because when we believe the solidity of that process. Then we feel like we have to defend it. We have to protect it. We have to get things to satisfy it. When we recognize, and this is actually something that I've found kind of a surprise for myself when I began having the actual experience that this being is simply a process, that there's no one here. No Andrea that's kind of like, you know, the little homunculus kind of, you know, sitting up in the head somewhere, you know. No Andrea like that. It's just a process. It can sound scary. You know, it can sound like, well, if I'm not here, you know, what's going on? Or, you know, it can feel like sand slipping out from under us, or, you know, so unstable to have this idea of not self. And what I've discovered, you know, these three kind of characteristics, you know, impermanence is the one that most people can say, I can see things are impermanent. You know, you go to anybody in downtown, you know, Redwood City, and ask them, are things permanent or things impermanent? Mostly they'll say, yeah, things are impermanent. You know, they'll sign up for that. But there's not a way that we actually experience things as impermanent. Our minds overlay permanence onto our experience, and we live in this delusion of permanence. But people can kind of sign up for this notion of impermanence. You know, with some reflection. Yeah, things are impermanent. I can believe that. And it doesn't seem to cause us too much distress to bring that thought into our mind. And yet, when we bring this notion of not-self into our mind, this can cause us some distress. Because this notion of self is so deep. It feels so potent and so true that I am Andrea. That it can feel kind of unsettling to contemplate that this me that I think is here is just a fiction. That can be very unsettling. But the actual experience I've had when I actually move into in the meditative space, what does it mean to really meet impermanence? That experience is pretty frightening. It can be kind of scary to meet just how rapidly experience is changing. The changing nature, that there's nothing really lasting for very long. That experience can be kind of unsettling. The experience of impermanence itself, the actual felt experience of impermanence, is pretty unsettling. The actual felt experience of not self, I actually discovered or felt that recognition. This is just a process. Now that was a relief. That was a sense of freedom. That was a sense of, I don't have to carry that burden around anymore. So it's very interesting, I think, that the fear around the ideas of the concepts of impermanence and not-self and the actuality of the experience are kind of flipped. You know, that we have this idea of not-self and we get all bent out of shape about that idea. But yeah, permanence, impermanence, I can sign up for that. But when we actually move into the experience, it's just the opposite. It's very unsettling to feel just how rapidly things are changing, but very easeful to recognize. No self, no problem. Our sense of me, mine, I, is kind of the birth of I need, I want, I have to have. And when that falls away, what a relief. Well, I'd hope to have some time for questions. There's about 3 minutes for questions, but anything you have to say. Emma's going to go first, and then you can go.
I guess I did not quite understand.
And that's this. Okay.
Okay. You know, for example, earlier you say Buddha say we tend to identify ourselves with our thoughts and feelings and bodies. Okay. And I will say that 10 years from today, my thinking will change. Mm-hmm. My body will change. Mm-hmm. My feeling will change. Even tomorrow, my feeling will change. So what's wrong with I don't have a sense that everything going to stay for the same forever. Uh-huh. So you must be talking about something, some special concept that people hold on to and they shouldn't. And I guess that's the thing I'm missing.
Well, it's kind of very subtle, this holding to identity. And yes, as you say, many of us have the sense, especially as we age, we really recognize that we've changed, you know, that we're no longer the same as we were when we were a child. And we begin to accept and understand, yeah, you know, 10 years from now, I'm going to be different. I'm going to change. But there's a way that we kind of congeal around what's happening now and say, this is me now. And it can be kind of a subtle thing. So, like, for instance, that, you know, climbing the Stairmaster, just watching how my mind kind of dropped into, oh, I am doing this. You know, there's just a sense of me being here. And it is a subtle concept. In fact, self is a concept. Self is an idea that gets born. And then we believe that concept. So it gets born, it takes shape, we believe it, and then another one gets born, it takes shape, we believe it. And another one gets born, it takes shape, we believe it. And somehow we feel like what happens is that we tend to believe that there's some kind of continuity in that. That somehow it's the same self that's born. I mean that's in all of those. So it's an exploration. And what I'd encourage, actually, the piece that I'd really encourage you to explore is when it feels like this is me. You know, what is it that feels like me? Just start looking at that. Just start exploring. What is it I take to be me? It's not that we're trying to get rid of a self, because there isn't one to get rid of anyway. So we're not trying to get rid of anything. We're trying to understand how our minds create this idea. And so explore for yourself. What is your sense of self? Like I explored that day on the retreat. You know, oh, this feeling of being this 40-year-old argumentative person. It was kind of like I had locked into that identity in that moment. Felt like, yeah, that's me. And all of my decisions, all of my thoughts were kind of coming out of that identity. And then it flipped. And I could see very quickly, I could see clearly how it flipped. And I could also see how identified I'd been in the previous moment. And how silly that was, because it was just a construct of the mind. So it is a construct of the mind that we ultimately believe. And so, but the key then is to look at what it is. What do we think of as self? And begin exploring that.
So you're talking about how we think of ourselves.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Like, I may think that I'm a very mature person today, and tomorrow I may have an experience that indicates that I'm not very mature.
Mm-hmm. And you could identify with either one of those. I mean, I've had the sense of the experience of identifying, I'm a great yogi, you know, feeling really good about myself. And then the next day, well, I'm a terrible yogi and feeling really horrible about myself. And beginning to recognize that those identities are actually feeding off of each other. Neither one is really true as who I am. It's what the feeling is in the moment. And we need to stop. So, So next week is Thanksgiving. We will not be meeting. And the following week, maybe I'll take questions that week. I'll open up to discussion since I didn't get to much today. So I'll see you in a couple of weeks.